Now, it should be noted in this context that CIA-1, the CIA group dubbed by the Interfor report, was using Manzar el-Qasar not only to help ship weapons to Iran, but also weapons to the Contras. Reviewing a couple of paragraphs here from the Pan Am 103 insurance investigators report, BKA CIA-1 approached Al-Qasar and offered to allow him to continue his drug smuggling routes, and especially into the U.S., if he helped arrange release of the American hostages via his well-placed contacts. Al-Qasar agreed to the deal, but continued his terrorism activities and told his cohorts that their smuggling through Pan Am Frankfurt at least was now protected and safe to the U.S. The next paragraphs are very important. However, Al-Qasar helped CIA-1 in sending weapons ostensibly to Iran through his buying connection, supposedly to further the U.S. hostage release. He also helped in another CIA-1 enterprise. He offered or agreed to use his other arms routes to purchase and transship arms to the Nicaraguan Contras. Our sources provided us detailed lists of items and dates and means of transportation for these shipments. Al-Qasar did this, of course, to induce CIA-1 to close its eyes and even protect his Pan Am Frankfurt drug route. At the same time, he became a CIA capability, quote-unquote. He even helped finance some of the Contra shipments with his drug profits. He also deceived CIA-1 by weapons shipments for terrorism in shipments which either included arms for or which were supposed to be for the Contras. Last two sentences again. He even helped finance some of the Contra shipments with his drug profits. He also deceived CIA-1 by weapons shipments for terrorism in shipments which either included arms for or which were supposed to be for the Contras. Some of these bombs were similar to those as used earlier in a terrorist attack against U.S. Army frequented nightclub and against a U.S. Army frequented nightclub in Berlin, and some were those later used against U.S. Army facilities in West Germany. What I wonder, and this is obviously only a question I'm asking, it's not a statement I'm making, I wonder if in fact the Gander plane was brought down by a terrorist bomb, if perhaps Manzar el-Qasar might have secreted one of these terrorist bombs alluded to in that last paragraph into some of the six crates that Gene Wheaton alluded to in the Joe Connison article from Details magazine. It obviously is not a statement we can make under the circumstances, but equally obviously I think it's a question that needs to be asked and hopefully answered in light of the similarities and important questions raised both by the Pan Am 103 investigation and the Gander investigation. I also wonder whether perhaps Manzar el-Qasar shipped the bomb eventually used by Per Anker Hansen, a.k.a. Amak Khalil, in the Lapenka bombing. And it's also worth noting, too, that the aforementioned Otfried Hepp and some of his third-position neo-Nazi buddies in Germany were involved not only with Abu Abbas and some of the Manzar el-Qasar associates in the aforementioned inter-terror group, but they also were involved in many of the terrorist attacks against U.S. military facilities in Europe. Those terrorist attacks generally cited by the Reagan administration as the work of the left or Palestinian terrorists and used to justify the continued aggressive military posture maintained by the Reagan-Bush administrations. This is, of course, in the category that I like to call food for thought and grounds for further research, but it certainly is a very thought-provoking question. Perhaps Manzar el-Qasar and the terrorist bombs shipped in Contra-related or apparently Contra-related weapons shipments, or Contra-destined weapon shipments, I should say, perhaps he was able to secret the bomb which brought down the Gander flight as well. There may actually be a hard link between Al-Qasar and not only the Pan Am 103 bombing, which is apparent, but perhaps to the Gander bombing as well. Food for thought and grounds for further research. We're going to take another short musical break, and then we're going to come back with a very, very important article, a bomb in and of itself, a critical article from L'Europeo magazine, obtained for us by Dave, which is going to tie up a number of different things. It's going to tie up Richard Brennecke, the P2, Arif Durrani, Stefano Della Chiai, Noriega, quite possibly the drug case, the Banco Ambrosiano, and a great many tentacles of the fascist octopus that we have been looking at for so many years here on this broadcast. Music, and then a critical article to be entered into tonight's archives. Now, this evening we are talking about what I have dubbed, for present purposes perhaps, December Surprise 2, although it occurred at an earlier point in time, namely December of 1985, as opposed to December of 1988, when the Pan Am 103 bombing took place. The crash of and apparent terrorist bombing of the Arrow Air flight that went down in Gander, Newfoundland, may very well be connected to the Pan Am 103 bombing. Certainly, there are disturbing indications that both were directly connected with the Iran-Contra scandal, and specifically the cover-up of the Iran-Contra scandal. We're now going to take a look at Arif Durrani, his role in the Iran-Contra scandal, and in particular, his connections with, among others, the P2 Lodge of Licio Gelli, SS Oberleutnant, intimate of, among others, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Richard Nixon, Jimmy Carter, and a whole lot of other people as well. Gelli, the Grand Master of the P2, a key player on the international stage over the last quarter of a century, an individual who has, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard. We're going to be looking at CIA connections to P2 tonight, something we looked at in Radio Free America 19, and we're going to be looking at how the CIA P2 connection apparently connected not only or was involved in not only the Iran-Contra scandal in a big way, but specifically we're going to take a look at Arif Durrani and his connections with this very same milieu. This particular article was researched and translated for us by Dave, our Italian translator. It is a blockbuster, as important an article as we have ever seen, and I want to thank Dave personally and encourage the listeners to do what they can to distribute information about this particular article. I've never seen a more important article, and it serves in many ways to highlight the correctness of the path of inquiry that I have taken over the years, and beyond that, and more importantly, that Mae Brussel, the late Mae Brussel, whose work serves as the foundation for my own, the direction that she took so presciently in the late 1960s. Most of the disturbing connections between elements of U.S. intelligence and the national security establishment and international terrorism that I look at here were anticipated by Mae's brilliant work many, many years ago. The following article comes to us, and there was an allusion to this, in the earlier article from La Repubblica of 8-1590. This particular article comes from L'Europeo magazine of August 25th of 1990. I'm going to read the entire article into the archives right now. And again, this particular article researched and translated by Dave. It's going to require a lot of interpolative discussion here. It's very dense, and there are a lot of important connections. But I will go into those after reading the story as a whole, the article as a whole. I will probably interrupt it at certain points just to underscore certain major items. The article, 825-90 from L'Europeo, reads as follows. Richard Brennecke, employee of Air America, recent photo shows him wearing Air America lapel pin, the company that served as a cover for the CIA in Southeast Asia, computer expert and financial engineer, master of clandestine operations from the purchase of arms in Czechoslovakia to the involvement of the agency, quote-unquote, in the drug traffic of the Medellin cartel. Contractor of the CIA until 1986. In the interview telecast by TG1 on July 1st, Brennecke revealed that the CIA, through Amitalia, A-M-I-T-A-L-I-A, had financed the P2 since 1970, and that the P2 had destabilized Italy by supporting terrorism and helping the arms and drug traffic. This is a major element here, interrupting the text, Amitalia. The link between the CIA and P2, according to Richard Brennecke, in Radio Free America 19, we took a look at the CIA's funding of Italian fascism under the auspices of anti-communism, unquote, and specifically we took a look at information developed by the Pike Committee on CIA misdeeds, which indicated that Michele Sindona, a P2 member and one of the key players in the Vatican banking scandals, had been the conduit for monies to Italian fascists to, among other things, precipitate the strategy of tension. Continuing here with the text. In his long interview with L'Europeo last week, the former secret agent, that's the aforementioned Richard Brennecke, the former secret agent repeated his version of the facts, adding that since 1975, the secret services of Italy have known about the activities of Amitalia. Again, Amitalia, the CIA link to P2. It's through Amitalia that the CIA finances P2, according to Brennecke. Continuing, he, Brennecke, reaffirmed that he'd known Licio Gelli for a long time and provided the phone number that he used to call the Grand Master and the phone bill. According to Brennecke, Gelli declared that he was ready to come to Italy to, quote, help Prime Minister Andreotti remember everything he'd forgotten, unquote. It goes without saying that the reactions were always the same. Brennecke is unreliable because the CIA maintains that they never had him on their payroll. However, we skip over the detail of the identification system. We skip over that the identification system of the agency is not the most reliable, as former agent Frank Snepp testified at Brennecke's recent trial. And we skip over the fact that in a secret FBI report, Special Agent John Borman made a handwritten notation that, quote, Brennecke sold arms to the PLO on orders from the CIA, unquote. It leaves us to wonder, however, why so often, concerning the statements of others of this so-called fanatic, one hears, quote, secrecy in the name of national security, unquote, invoked. If it's an attempt to keep unmentionable plots secret, then we can understand why Brennecke has decided to talk again. Quoting Brennecke here, Amitalia belonged to a financial network centered around the International Fund for Mergers and Acquisitions, IFMA, established in Panama on May 15th, 1970. That last sentence again. Quote, Amitalia, bear in mind that's the CIA P2 link, that's how CIA finances P2, Amitalia belonged to a financial network centered around the International Fund for Mergers and Acquisitions, or IFMA, established in Panama on May 15th, 1970. This link here, the IFMA, the International Fund for Mergers and Acquisitions, one of the most important connections here. It's located in Panama. It's how CIA funds P2. Continuing, about IFMA, the article continues, and quoting Richard Brennecke, it continues, IFMA Capital. Capital $5.15 million, to which was added IFMA Management Company, and the following year, IFMA Operating Company with a capital of $15 million. In the same period were also created the Australian Pacific Fund, the Australian Pacific Management Company, and the Australian Pacific External Company. Everything was under a single distribution company, Financiers International Limited, unquote. What was the capital of Amitalia? $5 million. If you examine this IBM report, you'll see that the persons involved are all the same. They only change functions, from director to treasurer, from secretary to vice president. How long did this organization function? Quote, until 1980. Then some names were irremediably erased, like Amitalia. The danger of news leaks didn't come from the higher-ups, but from officials at the lower level. So I was charged with seeing to the restructuring, unquote. Interrupting, again, Amitalia, a part of a financial network, Cindy, that's the P2 CIA link, how CIA funds P2, is part of an organization called the International Fund for Mergers and Acquisitions, IFMA, established in Panama on May 15th of 1970. It should be noted, too, that this organization has also been mentioned by Brennecke in connection with some of the savings and loans, which have been apparently looted in part by CIA and related elements to help fund, among other things, apparently the Contra War as well. Continuing here. The danger of news leaks, I'm repeating the last couple of sentences, the danger of news leaks didn't come from the higher-ups, but from officials at the lowest level, so I was charged with seeing to the restructuring. And again, we should note that IFMA has a number of closely related companies, with apparently the same people switching positions, at least according to Brennecke, in these closely related companies. Continuing. So some of the companies are still active? Quoting Brennecke, it's a matter of talking about very recent facts, unquote. But does this mean that they are still operating? Again, quoting Brennecke, IFMA still exists in Panama, and I continue to possess 49% of it. I don't know to whom the other 51% belongs. According to Noriega's former intelligence chief, Jose Blandon, B-L-A-N-D-O-N, the financial institution was very active in those days and was utilized by Noriega's collaborator, the former Mossad member Mike Harari. Documents must exist. I don't think the American invasion of Panama managed to destroy everything. And in Italy? Or do you want us to believe that after the interests of the 70s, everything ended? Very important sentence here. They're asking about Amitalia and Italy and IFMA and Italy. Quote, the company, and this is quoting Brennecke, the company Oliver North established in Switzerland, Lake Resources, was functioning, and that's not the only one. Unquote. That sentence again. The company Oliver North established in Switzerland, Lake Resources, was functioning, and that's not the only one. So Lake Resources apparently part of the IFMA financial tangle, which involves Amitalia, the P2 CIA link, and which was located in Panama. Continuing here. Is there anything else? Did the financial octopus suddenly have a single tentacle? Quote, I hope they all get cut off and don't grow back anymore. Otherwise, why would we be here talking about it? But there's another person who's reached this point and knows more. So again, bear in mind that it appears here that IFMA and the closely interrelated Amitalia were eventually gave rise to, among other things, some of the institutions used by Oliver North and the Enterprise, quote-unquote, in the Contra support effort and the attendant Iranian arms transfers. So IFMA, the International Fund for Mergers and Acquisitions, also cited by Brennecke as being involved in some of the CIA connections to the SNL scandal, Amitalia, the CIA P2 link, and some of Oliver North's front organizations used in Iran-Contra are all very closely interrelated, an incestuous relationship here, also worth noting the Panamanian connection. Now, in the drug tug case and also in the interrelated CIA connection to the SNL scandal, I noted the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle from Christmas Day of 1989 when Noriega turned up alive and well at the Vatican Embassy in Panama. At that point, Robert Pittner and David Hansen of respectively the Joseph Matthews Winery and Lenvest, two of the financial institutions, the business institutions used to apparently to launder money for the drug tug case, were hauled in Napa. And I speculated and I maintain that that had to happen. They had to be hauled in when Noriega turned up alive and well at the Vatican, because basically they represented loose cannons. They represented X-Factors. Had some of Noriega's people gotten to them and had they begun talking and Noriega begun talking, they could have spilled a lot of beans. It's also worth noting, as we looked at an article, as speculated about in an article we looked at from the British press, that perhaps Noriega turned himself into the Vatican embassy because he might have had intentions of blackmailing the U.S. concerning some of the Banco Ambrosiano connections, some of the CIA P2 connections, which we've looked at before. Recall that the Banco Ambrosiano, the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano, which as we looked at in Radio Free America 19, occurred in part because the P2 was using Ambrosiano funds for, among other things, arms purchases for the Falklands War in Argentina in 1982. Very strong Argentine P2 connections, as we looked at in Radio Free America 19. It's also worth noting that Michele Sindona, the conduit for CIA funds going to the Italian far right, according to Henrik Krüger in the Great Heroin Coup that we looked at in RFA 19, Michele Sindona claimed that the funds from Banco Ambrosiano were actually used to foment political reaction, anti-communist right-wing activities in Latin America. Worth noting that the bad loans that were made by Banco Ambrosiano and which brought it down were made through Panamanian shell companies. And, of course, those loans were guaranteed by the IOR, the Vatican Bank, whose head, Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, a Lithuanian, an American of Lithuanian extraction, well, he just resigned a short time ago. And so, again, I think the significance of the two articles on the front page of the Chronicle from Christmas Day of 1989 could not be exaggerated. I am convinced that that Noriega is turning himself into the Vatican embassy, the hauling in of two key players in the Lenvest situation, the Iran-Contra scandal, the P2 Lodge, the Vatican banking scandals are all interrelated. And I think the Amitalia International Fund for Mergers and Acquisitions link represents the key connection in this regard. We're now going to move on to the activities of Arif Durrani, the aforementioned Arif Durrani, a key player apparently in the Iran-Contra scandal, also an individual who had an arms firm called Merex that we'll talk about in a minute. Continuing here with the Il Europeo article. The other person is Arif Durrani, 41. Born in Pakistan, he moved to California in 1973. The owner of Merex, M-E-R-E-X, a war material firm, Durrani used it to work for the United States government. Or Durrani used to work for the United States government. Now, he's prisoner number 09027-014, housed in Unit 2P of the Federal Correctional Institution in Danbury, Connecticut. He was urgently transferred there from the penitentiary in Sheridan, Oregon, where Michael Scott, one of Brennecke's two lawyers, sought to meet with him. On July 9th, Scott explains, I talked on the phone with Durrani for almost 2 hours. Before entering a plea in Brennecke's case, we aimed at what we would say during the trial. It was decided that I would get to know Durrani and pick up certain documents. We made an appointment for the 16th. On the 11th, I acquired a ticket for Portland from Denver, where I lived. On the 13th, the other lawyer in our case, Richard Miller, called me and said that they were suddenly transferring Durrani, unquote. arrested October 3, 1986 for arms trafficking and sentenced to 10 years in prison and a $2 million fine, the Pakistani businessman has presented a demand for a retrial which will be discussed in September. His 218-page appeal confronts the Tower Commission report, North's depositions, and the Colonel's diary with a series of documents obtained from the Belgian Justice Ministry, including an inquiry by the Brussels gendarme into three companies implicated in the sale of war material: Casalee, C-A-S-A-L-L-E-E, Cosmic Trading, and Rheinmetall International. Noting on this page here, central point being that when Durrani was contacted by Richard Scott, a fellow who was working, or Michael Scott, excuse me, a fellow working for Richard Brennecke's defense team. Recall Brennecke recently acquitted of lying about the so-called October surprise. Durrani was quickly transferred from Sheridan, Oregon to Danbury, Connecticut. Continuing here, with also take note of the Merex firm, as we looked at in the review of Radio Free America 32 that we touched on last week. There was the Merex used by Manzar El-Kassar in the Aria deal. That Merex appears to, well, it was the same Merex that was founded by Gerhard Mertens, a World War II associate of SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny, a key player in the CIA Galen organization after World War II, a key developer of World War II of post-World War II terrorism, an individual we looked at in Radio Free America 22, and an individual, as we looked at in Radio Free America 19, a person who was directly connected to the P2, and specifically to the fascist coup attempt in 1970, led by Prince Giusto Valerio Borghese, and the so-called Rose of the Winds, or Rosa de Vente group that was in 1973, both grouped around the P2, both involving CIA, and both involving, among others, Michele Sindona. And in addition to the aforementioned Prince Giusto Valerio Borghese, also key names there, Stefano Della Chiai, and a guy named Vito Micheli, a member of the MSI, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, the Italian Fascist Party, closely allied with P2 and headed up at this point. Actually, the nominal head is Vittorio Mussolini, son of Il Duce. And remember, Stefano Della Chiai, will be coming back to him in just a minute. Continuing here with the L'Europeo article from 8/25 of 1990. The story, like all the stories of the last 10 years, leads in an obliged direction. The arms traffic with Iran, of which Durrani has been one of the protagonists. The son of Colonel Bashar, Colonel Bashari, B-A-S-H-A-R-I, the military supply director with the Pakistan Embassy in Washington, young Arif learned the art of dealing and appraising stocks of arms. For this, Tehran's new leaders entrusted him with controlling the materiel that was flowing through north. Tied also by common Muslim beliefs, Durrani made solid friendships with such personages as Supply Director Rahim Malekzadeh, M-A-L-E-K-Z-E-D-E-H, Revolutionary Guard Minister Rafiq Dost, D-O-S-T, and Ministerial Assistants Motion Razi, R-A-Z-Z-I, and Motion Kangerlu, K-A-N-G-E-R-L-U. They met when they were still students and became friends during long evenings in Middle Europe's cafes. In time, the relations he consolidated within this group made him one of the persons most valued by the Ayatollah's government. At that point, he was entrusted with the most sensitive of assignments, managing the money for the armaments purchases. The operations, Durrani explains, developed this way. I would draw the sum of money in Deutschmarks from the Sedrat Bank, S-E-D-R-A-T, and deposit it in Credit Suisse. Then I'd analyze the arms, make sure they were the quality and number of pieces agreed upon, and release the payments in dollars. This, again, the description of Durrani's function on behalf of P2 and the CIA in the Iranian arms transfers, reviewing those last few sentences. At that point, he was entrusted with the most sensitive of assignments, managing the money for the armaments purchases. The operations, Durrani explains, developed this way. I would draw the sum of money in Deutschmarks from the Sedrat Bank and deposit it in Credit Suisse. Then I'd analyze the arms, make sure that they were the quality and number of pieces agreed upon, and release the payment in dollars, unquote. Durrani recalls that, after he refused to guarantee a defective assignment, North's men took revenge on him by setting a trap. I was told that they had difficulty finding 240 spare parts for Hawk missiles already paid for by the Iranians, and I was asked to find them as soon as possible. The fate of the hostages in Beirut depended on my speed. But when, as agreed, I went to radio research in Danbury to conclude the matter, I found myself in front of Stephen Arruda, A-R-R-U-D-A, of Customs, who arrested me for the illegal trafficking of arms. Richard Brennecke alleges that, quote, Richard Brennecke, actually, this is Loropeo interrogating him here. Richard Brennecke alleges that you also knew all about the financial network that supported Amatalia. Is that true? And now quoting Durrani, the thing I can confirm at the moment is that Amatalia was replaced by North's group, the Enterprise, which monopolized all the exchanges with Iran. That last sentence again, because it's a doozy. Quote, and again we're quoting Durrani here, the thing I can confirm at the moment is that Amatalia was replaced by North's group, the Enterprise, which monopolized all the exchanges with Iran. Direct your attention to Lake Resources and the firm that controlled it, CSF, in Geneva. You'll find that they were not only occupied with Iran, but with other countries as well. The arms left Portugal, Belgium, and Spain, but in the background always appeared the shadow of the CIA. And how was Italy involved? Quote, in Italy is located a great deal of NATO material. Bear in mind that Tehran had desperate need of war material, but not just any type. Only the kind compatible with the equipment acquired in the United States at the time of the Shah. From Italian ports, many loads of munitions left for Bandar Abbas, ABBAS. Many deliveries came from Consale, which is a CIA front company operating in Brussels and Switzerland. I have the proof of everything that I assert. Also of the intermediation carried out for the purchase of 30,000 Beretta machine pistols on behalf of the Pakistani army. But what's so strange about that? Quote, that the CIA has always controlled the Pakistani army, and that the arms they acquired frequently had other final destinations. In every case, as far as Italy is concerned, one of the cruxes was the P2. This last couple of sentences again, basically, at least according to Durrani, the CIA ran the Pakistani army and frequently used it as a vehicle for trafficking arms to various areas. And asking here, what's so strange about that, about the purchase of 30,000 Beretta machine pistols for the Pakistani army? What's so strange about that? Quote, that the CIA has always controlled the Pakistani army, and that the arms they acquired frequently had other final destinations. In every case, as far as Italy is concerned, one of the cruxes was the P2, unquote. Have you direct knowledge of everything you say? Quote, my Iranian friends told me in 1984 that the P2 had been in touch with them since the end of 1981. Rahim Malelzadeh, M-A-L-L-E-L-Z-E-D-E-H, revealed to me that the first meeting took place in a big mosque in Frankfurt because the lodge had a proposal for them, drugs in exchange for arms if they don't have enough money. One more time, that last sentence, last couple of sentences. My Iranian friends told me in 1984 that the P2 had been in touch with them since the end of 1981. Rahim Malelzadeh revealed to me that the first meeting took place in a big mosque in Frankfurt because the lodge had a proposal for them, drugs in exchange for arms if they don't have enough money, unquote. Do you know whether this became the rule? Quote, it's possible, and it wouldn't be the first time. I have proof that the United States Customs informed the government that the airline companies controlled by the CIA were importing drugs. And the reply was, quote, don't interfere, unquote. Who represented the point of contact between the P2 and Tehran? Quote, Stefano Della Chiai was very close to Ayatollah Montazeri and was well aware of Iran's situation because he'd resided there since the period of the Shah. He had an office at the Intercontinental Hotel and had acted as a representative for such Italian industries as Oto Melara and Selenia. Oto Melara is O-T-O-M-E-L-A-R-A and Selenia S-E-L-E-N-I-A. Continuing, the he here, of course, Stefano Della Chiai, key author of the Strategy of Tension, key associate of the P2, collaborator of the CIA, and at least according to Arif Durrani, the contact point between P2 and the Iranians for the Iran-Contra arms transactions conducted by P2 on behalf of CIA and company. No pun intended. He, Della Chiai, he used to be officially shown the catalogs of their products. Sales were very active for a couple of years and reached their height in 1983. Then the market changed. North Korea and China entered. But above all, Oliver North and his group decided to monopolize the traffic and reorganize at any cost the competition. You maintain that in exchange for arms, the P2 accepted drugs. How did they arrive in Italy? Very important sentence coming up, a couple of sentences. Quote, They used a certain company in Palermo that also imported Marlboro cigarettes from Paraguay. From Paraguay? Exactly. I didn't know until it was over, as a matter of fact, Durrani laughs, but they have some connection with Abu Nidal, whom I know well. I met him in 1985 in Paris. Interrupting here. Now, it's worth noting that Stibom International, a major arms and drugs trafficking firm with very strong connections not only to the P2, but also to Western intelligence, the CIA, and other elements of U.S. intelligence in particular. Stibom was one of the principal elements that we looked at in connection with the Pope shooting. We looked at it in connection with the Pope shooting in Radio Free America 20. We came back to it in number 25 in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. And again, in some of the supplements to Radio Free America 34 dealing with the Shikarki AG case, intersecting elements between Iran-Contra and Stibom were discussed at great length. They operate, although they were based in Milan, and in fact, Stibom International rented their offices. Their headquarters was rented from Banco Ambrosiano in the Banco Ambrosiano headquarters building. It's worth noting that one of their major operations was in Palermo, and that their Stibom International was shut down as a result of a bust in Palermo. Its head was Henry Arsan, a fellow who worked for the Drug Enforcement Agency. And beyond that, Arsan, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 20, also very much involved with importing cigarettes. Now, whether that's the reference here to Palermo remains to be seen, but we do know, and again, RFAs 20 and 25 will document this, that Stibom very much involved with the Iranian arms transfers, also very much involved with P2, also people like Eugene Bartholomaeus and other associates of Edwin Wilson associated with Stibom, and again, RFAs 20 and 25, whether or not that's the cigarette importing reference alluded to here remains to be determined, but it certainly is food for thought and grounds for further research. Note also the Abu Nidal connection here. Abu Nidal, of course, part of the Interterror Group, associate of Manzur el-Kassar, one of the elements first mentioned in connection with the bombing of Pan Am 103. Continuing here with the Europeo interrogation, or interview with Durrani. Angeli, do you know him? Yes, I've heard the name. There's people who love to talk, and there's people who prefer to listen. And bear in mind that unlike many others, I always prove what I say. Because of this, I became an embarrassing case. You see, Brennecke, who's already provoked too much agitation, remembers things that happened in the past. I can explain things from the present. For this reason, I'm the only one, the last of those who are in some way involved, left to rot in prison, unquote. But what are they afraid that you could say? Quote, I've seen the documents. I've read them. I've listened to my Iranian friends. There's nothing special about the relations with North and his controllers that I don't know. Do you know what George Bush's code name in the international dossiers of Tehran was? Bosch Battery, B-O-S-C-H, by the way, that's a key German industrial firm, Bosch Battery. Yes, like the batteries of cars. And I assure you it's cited frequently. I have many papers about this that might interest you, and many notes on the P2, but I don't keep them here in jail. But I can easily arrange it. Last couple of sentences again. But what are they afraid that you could say? I've seen the documents. I've read them. I've listened to my Iranian friends. There's nothing special about the relations with North and his controllers that I don't know. Do you know what George Bush's code name in the internal dossiers of Tehran was? Bosch Battery. Yes, like the batteries of cars. And I assure you it's cited frequently. I have many papers about this that might interest you and many notes on the P2. But I don't keep them here in jail, but I can easily arrange it, unquote. At the end of the meeting, after 2.5 hours of conversation, Arif Durrani returns to his cell to pick up the document. 10 minutes pass, then 15. He still doesn't come down. Then the telephone in the visitor's room rings. Executive assistant Natalie Landy, L-A-N-D-Y, answers it quickly. Her voice filters out thickly between the prison and the outside. Quote, Mr. Durrani doesn't want to come down anymore. Forget it. Unquote. Greetings and information requests drag on. Another quarter hour passes. At the end of the corridor, Durrani appears with a cover over his arm. He utters a few sentences in a low voice. Quote, I don't think you'd want to come back anymore. I'm not permitted to come down. The guard told me, quote, give me those papers. I'll take them there. Unquote. I refused, but I hoped in time to convince him. End quote. The following day, in a short phone call, Arif communicates that he is isolated in his wing. He can't leave his cell and walk through the prison. He can't send letters and isn't assigned a cellmate. The harshest punishment, only one 10-minute phone call every 30 days. Quote, They don't want meetings with the press and seek to obstruct me in every way, unquote. In Sheridan, Oregon, on the order of Judge Holly Fitzsimmons, they confiscate from Durrani all the material he gathered for his retrial. One more time. In Sheridan, Oregon, on the order of Judge Holly Fitzsimmons, they confiscate from Durrani all the material he gathered for his retrial. An act of scandalous illegality, considering that Durrani is preparing for his retrial only from his petition. A few days before our meeting, they prevented him from meeting his lawyer with the usual tactics, i.e., forgetting to tell one that the other is waiting or has already left. In these difficult conditions, Arif Durrani sees few people and doesn't want to give statements. Yet the usual rumors are already circulating. Quote, Durrani, a discredited personage, like Brennecke, unquote. And that is the end of that very, very important article. Well, let's go back over some of the major points. Now, again, we looked at Amitalia. We looked at the International Fund for Mergers and Acquisitions based in Panama. That is the financial complex of which Amitalia is a part. And according to both Richard Brennecke and Arif Durrani, Amitalia gave way directly to North's resources. In other words, the functions performed by Amitalia and IFMA were supplanted by and gave direct rise to, I guess you could say they evolved into, the enterprise run by Oliver North. Worth noting that George Bush was heavily involved with this, as has been intimated by so many people. Bush was heavily involved with the Iran-Contra scandal, his frequent denials to the contrary notwithstanding. It's worth noting that Stefano Della Chiaia, key author of the Strategy of Tension, key intimate of P2 and a major subject of RFA-19, that Stefano Della Chiaia, according to Durrani, a key point of contact between the P2 and the Iranians on behalf of CIA, obviously, for the Iranian arms transfers. And it's worth noting again that George Bush was heavily involved in this. Worth noting, too, that apparently as soon as Arif Durrani went to get a hold of the documents that he could have used to prove his allegations, he was subjected to some rather extraordinary extra-legal procedures in order to prevent his disclosures from going further than they already had. It's also worth noting that some of the initial contacts between P2 and the Iranians occurred in a mosque in Frankfurt. Whether or not that in any way connects up with the Frankfurt connection and the Pan Am 103 bombing is anybody's guess. Food for thought and grounds for further research, as I like to say. And again, the Bush connection here is one that we should not overlook. So once again, Amitalia, CIA linked to P2, the International Fund for Mergers and Acquisitions located in Panama, the enterprise by Oliver North, all very much involved with one another. Basically, they are intermingling, they are commingled. Amitalia, part of IFMA, and it evolves, according to Durrani and Brennecke, into the enterprise run by Oliver North with its many, many tentacles, as they put it here. A blockbuster article, one whose importance could not be exaggerated, and it goes to highlight a number of the lines of inquiry that we have been developing over the years here. And the P2 CIA Iran-Contra connection focused on in Radio Free America shows 25, 32, and 34 is obviously front and center here. In my December surprise hypothesis, I mentioned that I felt that the Pizza Connection 4 bust, which occurred on December 2nd, 1988, the same day that the Amiram near death and the Reagan refusal to disclose or to release documents to Lawrence Walsh, those all appeared in the press on the same day, that the thing that was so significant about the Pizza Connection 4 bust is that because it could have revealed the P2 and CIA connections to the Iran-Contra scandal, the Pope shooting, and other things that interrelate with this particular tangle. That is what is so significant about the Pizza Connection 4 bust in the December surprise hypothesis. It basically could have disclosed some of these CIA P2 connections had it unraveled, and in supplements to Radio Free America 34 developed after the original December surprise broadcast, we took a look at the Shikarki AG case, which connects up the Pizza Connection cases, the Iran-Contra scandal, the P2, and the Pope shooting, and a number of the activities looked at in RFAs 17 through 21. We should also mention in this regard the Valsala Mecanotecnica case that we looked at in RFA 32, strong connecting elements to many of these same many of the same organizations. Supplements about Valsala Mecanotecnica contained in RFA 34.
I'm going to take a short musical break, then we're going to come back with the concluding articles of tonight's broadcast.
Well, good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. We've just been looking at a blockbuster article from Europeo magazine, which basically links the P2 and specifically CIA funding of P2 and a series of financial conduits for that purpose with the Iran-Contra scandal. Now, the key point is the evolutionary continuity between Amitalia, identified by Brennecke and Durrani as the CIA link to P2, the International Fund for Mergers and Acquisitions in Panama, and Oliver North's enterprise, Lake Resources in particular. So that continuity is the central element there. Note the Bush role, Bosch Battery, as apparently he was referred to by the Iranians in their documents. Note also that Stefano Della Chiaia, according to Durrani, the key link between the Iranians and the P2. It's worth noting that Stefano Della Chiaia is a key player in the fascist third position. We looked at that relying on, among other things, an article from Mother Jones magazine from May of 1987, a very important article by Martin Lee and Kevin Coogan called Killers on the Right, Europe's New Fascists, dealing with the fascist third position. That article is read almost in its entirety. In fact, it is read in its entirety in the miscellaneous archive show about the fascist third position. The fascist third position, basically, to make a long story short, is a form of fascism, a fascist ideology which aims at attracting certain segments of the progressive political sector to the fascist cause by embracing certain sections of certain elements of progressive political philosophy, such as a pro-ecology stance, and it basically aims at hoodwinking progressive people into a fascist political alliance or a fascist political stance. It's worth noting that the fascist third position has formed very strong links with Middle Eastern terrorists, both Palestinian terrorists and Iranian-linked Shia fundamentalists. And it's worth noting, too, that among the heroes of the fascist third position are Muammar Gaddafi, Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran, and also Louis Farrakhan of the American Nation of Islam. We will go into the fascist third position in next week's discussion in the program that we're going to do next week. I think it's worth noting a couple of things that the Merex alluded to in that particular article is the same Merex, the Durrani Merex, I guess you could say, that we looked at in an article from the Atlanta Constitution that was included in the segment of Radio Free America 32, which we reviewed last week. Whether or not that's the same Merex that we looked at in connection with the Aria deal, and again, the Merex that was founded by Gerhard Mertens, a fellow who worked with Otto Skorzeny during World War II. Skorzeny was heavily involved with Merex, and we've looked at Merex in Radio Free America's 19 and 32. It's worth noting that Otto Skorzeny was a fellow very much associated with the P2 in the aforementioned Borghese coup attempt of 1970 and the Rosa Devente coup attempt, or coup group, in 1973. Again, RFA 19, we looked at that, and it's worth noting that Michele Sindona helped channel funds from the CIA to that same group, because Sindona of the P2, and it would appear, at least from the information developed in that Europeo article, that Amitalia was probably the conduit for the Sindona funds that went to P2 and the Borghese and Rosa Devente coup groups. It's worth noting, too, that in the article from Jonathan Marshall's Parapolitics that we covered in RFA 32 and that we reviewed last week, Merex was used as a front for the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German intelligence service, and a final incarnation of the Gehlen organization, which employed, among others, Otto Skorzeny, that Merex was used as a front for funding right-wing Italian terrorism and arming right-wing Italian terrorism, and that the key contact point for that was a fellow named Guido Gianottini. Now, as we looked at in Radio Free America 30, Radio Free America 19, and as we came back to in the article about the fascist third position, Guido Gianottini was a member of the P2 and specifically allied with a third position segment of P2. That information, again, coming from a book called St. Peter's Banker by Luigi D'Afonso. Guido Gianottini also heavily involved in the Piazza Fontana massacre in 1969. That bombing, that terrorist bombing, initially blamed on the left and used as an excuse to crack down on the Italian left. That bombing was in fact perpetrated by the right, the P2, Stefano Della Chiaia, and Guido Gianottini in particular.
And again, Stefano Della Chiaia of Piazza Fontana, P2 and Strategy of Tension fame, apparently, according to the article we just looked at, the key contact point between the Iranians and the P2, both the Iranians and Stefano Della Chiaia to be found within the context of the fascist third position.